Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntress here. Much like Bruce Wayne, I have moved the Batcave from its out in the burbs, 14 miles from Gotham City, straight to the heart of the city. And consider me broadcasting now from the sub-basement of the Wayne Foundation as I take up my new digs, much like Bruce and Alfred did after Dick Grayson went back to Hudson University. And that kind of dovetails into today's focus of Word Balloon. It's looking back at a bunch of Batman interviews. This is the 75th year for Batman, and a lot of great Batman projects have been coming out. Certainly everyone is excited that the Batman 66 DVD is finally out. And it looks like it has great bonus stuff, and great to see all the old episodes looking as pristine as they have been. We also have Brett Culp's documentary, Legends of the Night. Lots of other great Batman-inspired animation and great things. And in addition to that, we can look back on the history of Word Balloon and look at some very interesting perspectives on the character of Batman and also how that character inspired others who took up both the mantle of Batman or in the case of some of the Club of Heroes characters that were explored in Grant Morrison's run on Batman, guys like the Knight, what their perspective of Batman was as they approached being a hero themselves. And we do this in conversation with several great creators that have been on over the years on Word Balloon. And, you know, they're not obvious names when you think of Batman, but then when you hear them, you're like, of course, that was a big, important Batman story. So it's great to talk to Frank Quitely about his run on Batman and Robin with Grant Morrison. And at the same time, because it was live on the floor of New York Comic Con, Chris Burnham talking about Batman Incorporated. You'll hear Matt Wagner talk about his experience on a Batman panel that inspired an interesting theory that starts with Batman, but you can extrapolate with a lot of 20th century heroes and how they're portrayed. Paul Cornell is going to be on to talk about his run on Knight and Squire, which I thought was just fantastic, him and Jimmy Broxton. And again, a very British perspective of a Batman-inspired character and how it plays out in British society. Paul also had a great run playing with Dick Grayson as Batman on Batman and Robin, and we talk about that, including the meeting and working together of Lex Luthor and Ra's al Ghul. Brian Azzarello, of course, had his wonderful runs on Batman in various ways, but this focus today is on the Flashpoint miniseries of Thomas Wayne as Batman, and that very tragic but very interesting three-issue story. It was the full 100 Bullets team of Azzarello, Riso, and Dave Johnson covers, and they did not disappoint. It really is a classic Batman story that doesn't feature Bruce Wayne at all. There is one Bruce Wayne story, and that involves the great Walt Simonson talking about a Bronze Age sketch request that started off as a sketch, became a cover, and ultimately became the inspiration for a very good Batman Joker story. And we get the full story from Walt Simonson on that. We have Francesco Francavilla to talk about his portion of the Black Mirror story. On our last episode, we talked about it more with Scott Snyder. I can't help it. It literally is one of my favorite all-time Batman stories. And again, Bruce is nowhere to be found. And it's great to hear Francesco's thoughts on his run on Detective Comics, those great 11 issues. And we finish up with filmmaker Brett Culp, who, as I said earlier, his film Legends of the Night, the great documentary, real-life people that were inspired by the Batman character and made a difference in their own lives and in others' lives. And it really is a great documentary and worthy of your attention. And it's out on DVD now. So that and more coming up on today's Word Balloon. It's all brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. And now that it's holiday season, you can save a lot of money, even up to 70% on select Dark Horse titles at InStockTrades.com. 70% on select Marvel trades. IDW Artist Edition sale going on right now at InStockTrades.com. All of those are great starting points for interesting Christmas gifts. And then, you know, if you want to turn on somebody to comics and are looking for, you know, unconventional stories, but I think that will grab people's attention the same way The Walking Dead has done with so many people. How about Casanova? You can get the complete edition hardcover volume 1. Gabriel Ba, Fabio Moon, Matt Fraction. Luxuria is available now at 50% off, just $14.99. Lazarus, that great series by Greg Rucka and Mike Lark. Volume 1 hardcover is available now at 50% off, $17.49. You can get Saga from Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples, 50% off, $24.99. And then if they are superhero fans, well, there's lots to be added from InStockTrades.com. You can get things like Teen Titans Earth 1 hardcover, Volume 1, 50% off, just $11.49. You can get the Silver Surfer Epic Collection trade paperback, When Calls Galactus, 50% off, $17.49. Yeah, I'm going to go back to creator-owned stuff. How about Matt Kind and Mind Management, Volume 4, Magician, is 42% off, $11.49. Don't worry, there's lots of great stuff waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. You know the drill. If your orders are $50 or more, you receive free shipping. They make it easy. They've got great books at prices you can't beat. Check them out for yourself, InStockTrades.com. Word Balloon is also brought to you by the League of Word Balloon listeners. Thank you for your continued support of Word Balloon. Go to wordballoon.com and click on the Subscribe to Word Balloon tab, and it'll take you to the page that explains how to subscribe via Patreon and some of the other premiums that we offer if you want to help things out here at Word Balloon. Thank you truly for your support, and I try to thank you back by giving you the best content that I can, premium content on occasion when I'm able to get out and get some quick exclusive interviews and let you get a sneak preview of those. But other great content as well for being a Patreon subscriber and some of the other premiums I offer as well at wordballoon.com. Go check it out for yourself. All right, let's get our conversation started. First of all, New York Comic Con a few years ago, Chris Burnham did me a solid. And it's like, hey, have you met Frank Quitely? And I'm like, why, no. It would be a pleasure to meet Frank Quitely. And it was really great. It was brief, but we got to talk about his run on Batman and Robin and ideas that he had for Dick Grayson as Batman. Professor Pig, the creation of Professor Pig, and working with Grant Morrison. Not only that, but also mentioning the current multiversity issue that just came out. Frank talks a bit about that. And from Burnham, we get, of course, his perspective on Batman Incorporated and what was coming then, the transition to Batman Leviathan, and the wrap-up to at least, you know, that portion of the Damian story, which is still ongoing. But let's hear now from Frank Quitely and Chris Burnham and a surprise guest on the floor of New York Comic Con to start things off on today's Word Balloon.
This is good. I get to do dueling Batman artists, the men who work with Grant Morrison. I got Frank Quitely here, and I've got Chris Burnham. And Chris is doing commerce, so I'll take a moment with Frank right now. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Well, thanks. Pleasure to meet you, too.
Obviously, wonderful run on Batman and Robin.
Well, thanks very much. I had originally been slated for the first three and the last three, and catching the deadline for the third one, my sciatica problem came back.
Oh, wow.
And I was like 3 months off work completely, and then like 6 months just working really slowly, you know, or working, you know, with,
sure,
you know, like 5 minutes and then taking a 5 minute break, you know, that kind of thing.
Wow.
It was, yeah, it was really bad. So back to full health now, but obviously the disappointment was that I didn't get to do the Joker, you know.
Sure,
but
sure.
Can you do?
Yeah, well, you know, honestly, what I loved, especially in the early issues, and especially that first issue, the weight of the world on Dick Grayson's shoulders in that one, you know, panel.
Yeah,
I just thought really kind of encapsulated the character at that moment and everything. You really felt the anguish that he was going through and that weight of being Batman.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, he had a job in his hands. He wasn't just filling in for Batman, which is an impossibly big shoes to fill, but he was also had the whole Damian problem as well, and Damian had absolutely no respect for him, and you know, it's, but yeah, I mean, it was, they're cool stories, you know, and I'm sure Chris would agree, you know, like, it's, we're kind of, to some extent, you know, we're at the mercy of what kind of scripts we end up working on. You can always do your best work, but it is noticeable that despite the fact that I always try and do my best work no matter who I'm working with, it's always with the better scripts. That, you know, that's when people come back and say, that really moved me, or that, you know. And you're probably the same, you know.
Yeah.
Like, working with Grant is, you know, it's a treat.
Absolutely, yeah. Chris, you know, have you guys had a chance to compare notes?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, we just met last night for the first time, and I think we hit it off pretty well. But yeah, I mean, the comic that people have responded to the most my whole career was the Batman Inc. number 7 with the, on the Indian Reservation.
Absolutely.
And I mean, I did a really good job drawing it, I think, but it's not, I didn't do a better job drawing it than issue 4 or 6, but for whatever reason, the emotional resonance, I guess, art seem better, because you're,
yeah,
so much more invested in it, so you're really you're not just casually flipping through it. You're, you know, pouring yourself into it. So, you know, whatever effort I put into the drawings, you know, pays off more for the reader that way.
How's it been creating certain characters for both of your runs? I mean, like Professor Pig. I mean, you know, wasn't that one of your guys, obviously?
Yeah. it was brilliant because, like, when Grant started talking about it, he's like, we're going to have this these kind of circus freaks, and, you know, they'll be like... And he started describing them, and they were... It was all just the sort of shit that I would draw in my sketchbook anyway. It was really, yeah. It was one of those occasions where something comes along that really feels like it fits right, you know?
Chris, have you created any characters yet for Batman Incorporated?
Well, I did that the initial version of Batwing, which I'm not sure how successful that was. I like the new... I like the redesign a lot more. And, I redesigned Cassandra Cain as the Black Bat. I like that a lot. So that was interesting, you know, taking Grant's notes and, you know, spinning off and trying to come up with something cool. But I haven't really... trying to think. I haven't really created a major character, like, out of full cloth, really.
Chris has to deal with Grant from a transatlantic point and different time zones and stuff. You guys live really close, don't you?
We live fairly close. Well, Grant actually spends about half the year in LA. Okay. So, we live fairly close, but... obviously I can usually, like...
Do you guys get together and talk, or is it mostly on the phone, or...?
Yeah, well, normally when we start a new project, we always get together and talk about it at that stage, and then after that, usually just, you know, like, I send an email.
Sure.
And Kristen, his wife, gets back to me and tells me what his answer was, you know, but...
Grant's not too tech-savvy, huh?
The thing is, though, you know, like... People always say, what did he do before he get married? And what he did was he just didn't answer the phone. I won't name names, but I've heard various stories, not just from Grant, but from the editors themselves, about, like, working on projects for quite some time, and Grant just wouldn't answer the phone to them. Because he's working and he's not interested in answering the phone. You're like, come on, you know. Anyway.
Well, I know he's reached a good level of relationship with Chris, but I know he adores you. I mean, he always talks you up at the panels and stuff.
I was in
San Diego and had some great stories.
Yeah, well, we just, you know, like, we really like working with each other, you know. I've never worked on anything with Grant that's felt kind of, like, by the numbers. Everything's always... Oh, yeah. The new X-Men stuff, the scripts were fantastic. Obviously, I don't feel quite as close to that because it wasn't like a single, like, project the way, like, All-Star Superman or V3 were. Like, it was just the two of us, start to finish. But, you know, it's also fun, both on new X-Men and in Batman and Robin, when you're working with other artists, you know, and, like, somebody else is drawing this bit first, so you've got to follow their lead, and, oh, you know, all that kind of thing. So, yeah.
So with Leviathan coming up, how's the work? I know, let's actually go with what's coming up and then to next year, and obviously tell me what you guys can tell me. There's still, is it a double issue that's coming out of Batman Incorporated?
I believe so. The plans on that, and what we're talking about is what was originally going to be issues 9 and 10 of Batman Incorporated. Issue 9 was Cameron Stewart's issue, and issue 10 is mine. And the format that's going to be released in, I'm not quite sure of, to be honest. But it is nearly done. It is totally awesome. It is by far the Grant Morrison-iest thing I've ever done. So I'm getting to do one of the Granty ones. It's pretty crazy.
Excellent. And then are you working with Grant on Leviathan? Or because I forget what you guys might be working on in the future.
No, I'm doing one of Grant's Multiversity books.
There we go. Okay, yeah. It was Multiversity. Okay.
Pax Americana, that's the Charlton characters.
Fantastic.
So, yeah.
Awesome, man.
So far, I've only got 8 pages of script so far.
Okay.
And they're thumbnailed, and I've started penciling, so...
Wonderful.
It's up and running. It's on its way.
I can't wait to see the designs you're going to come up with the Charlton characters. I'm sure they're going to be pretty interesting.
We'll see.
Fair enough, man. When, as I said before we started recording, I'd love to get you on for a longer word balloon. It'd be a pleasure to talk to you, man. So very cool.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Awesome. Yep. Well, yeah, I'm not going to keep you guys. I know you guys have got a usual busy con schedule. And Burnham's got a line going. So there we go. And there's, wow, and there, man, I'll tell you, this is awesome. It's like a Batman trifecta because Matt Wagner just walked up.
How are you, brother?
How you doing? Good to see you, man.
good love connection right now.
I gave up on trying to connect to you, but oh well.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's
happenstance.
And Wagner's got something coming up with Legendary Comics.
I do.
And that's cool. Did they announce it this weekend? I know there was a
panel
tonight.
They announced it in San Diego. We just finished talking about it at the panel. Yep. It's a new series called The Tower Chronicles.
Awesome.
I'm writing. Simon Bisley's drawing.
Wow. Fantastic.
Yeah. Yep.
That's cool.
All right, and I just so quietly, when we're closer and everything, that we'll do a longer conversation, and now that your thing's announced, when are they looking for first issue?
He starts drawing in November 1st, so it's going to be...
March issue, maybe? Or?
Ultimately, it's three graphic novels, but they're broken up into 64-page prestige issues.
Outstanding.
So, I don't know how... I've never really worked with Simon on a narrative sense, so I don't know how long he takes to do stuff. So
that's cool. I'm a patient man, Matt.
I'm almost done finished writing the third of those four. So
awesome.
That's great. Well, all right. Well, I'm going to let these guys have a private conversation and say, looking forward to our talk, looking forward to our talk, and Burnham, looking forward to our talk. So thank you for making the love connection. I appreciate that.
Yeah, my pleasure, buddy.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Okay, you heard Matt Wagner suddenly pop up at the end of that exchange, and it was great. And as promised, we immediately set up an interview in a couple months, and we had Matt back on. And we talked about a lot of things, but one of the things we talked about was an interesting Batman panel that he was a part of. And he, to kind of, as he said, stir things up, presented a very interesting theory that became a point of discussion. I will let Matt tell you the story now on Word Balloon.
I was on a Batman panel, and it was me and Mark Evanier and Steve Englehart and Michael Uslan.
Okay.
And, you know, everybody's pretty much on the same page. It's all kind of like, yeah, we love Batman, you know.
I mean, yay, Batman, sure.
What can you say, you know? And so then I decided to kind of stir up the pot a little bit and introduce the theory that it became a little more provocative than I thought it would be. I said, look, I'd like to make the point and ask the panel what they think about this, in that I think pretty much any pop culture character is endemic to the time and place they were created. And by that I mean Sherlock Holmes can't exist out of Victorian London. The shadow doesn't really work in a time where every man on the street wasn't wearing a hat. And similarly, I think even though Batman and Superman have had very amazing longevities, I think that their characters are based around the society and the technology of the late 20th century. And that I think we might be seeing that come to an end before too long, that you won't be able to update those characters anymore. Even though they've had many successful retcons over the year. But, you know, in an age when every single character, every single person in the world carries a portable camera in the form of their phone and can immediately access pretty much the internet and spread information around the globe in a matter of seconds, it's really hard for it to be believable that any character could maintain a secret identity.
Interesting.
And that's why I think the Marvel characters kind of replaced them, specifically the X-Men, has really come to the forefront because they, if you think about it, they are characters who exist without a sense of privacy, whose powers and abnormal characteristics have thrust them into a limelight against their will. And they can't have secret identities. They try and hide out, and it doesn't work for them. The rest of the panel just wasn't catching what I was trying to say there. They viewed it more as kind of like an attack on Batman, you know. And I was just kind of like, look, Batman's great. I understand that. I agree with that, you know. And somebody made the point, well, these sort of stories are, you know, they're eternal. They go back to the days of Beowulf and Odysseus. And I said, look, I can talk that Campbellian archetype all day long, you know.
Yes, you can.
But Odysseus, you know, wore sandals and had a bronze shield and a sword. You don't see guys using that in modern-day New York. Similarly, you know, you're not – the structures that made Batman and Superman stories unique aren't going to resonate – with either viewers or readers at a certain point. By way of illustration, I said, look at it this way. What does Clark Kent work for?
That's where I was going to ask you in terms of where to go next in this
talk. He works for a newspaper.
Yes.
Those are
dinosaurs.
They're becoming obsolete.
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely. But much like they did in the 70s, putting him in television, which presented its own problems.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Both in the story and I think writing stories. But, no, I agree with you, and I understand where you're coming from on
and
that.
And it wasn't, you know, again, I was not trying to attack those characters at all. I think those characters are wonderful, and there will come a point where it's like we can't keep updating these because, again, they're based on the world of the late 20th century, the latter half of the 20th century, and it won't be too long till the latter half of the 20th century is a memory. It isn't as immediate as it is right now.
So there you go. Earlier we heard Frank Quitely and talking about his perspective on the Batman mythos and, you know, Dick as Batman and stuff. Paul Cornell, another great writer, one of my favorites, whether it's been his Doctor Who writing and his wonderful original stuff, but certainly Captain Britain and an MI-13 and at DC, very interesting projects that he worked on over the years. And among them, he had a nice run on Batman and Robin, which involved Lex Luthor and Ra's al Ghul. But also, my personal favorite, inspired from Grant Morrison's Club of Heroes, The Knight and the Squire, drawn by Jimmy Broxton. And they really let Paul cut loose and give us a very, very British interpretation of the Batman ideal and how it might play out in the DC universe in Great Britain. I love it, and it really was a fun miniseries, and it is worthy of your attention. You should seek it out if you haven't read it. I'll let Paul describe it more now on Word Balloon.
Let's start with what's coming out this week. It's the third issue of Knight and Squire.
Yeah, it's my favorite ever comic book that I've written. I wrote the solicitation, which ends with, yes, that's the plot. I'm amazed with that they're letting me get away with this. It is the story of, the Ricardian Society, who are they have their counterparts in real life, people who think that Richard III was the greatest king Britain has ever known, and not at all like Shakespeare portrayed him as a scheming evil villain. And so they resurrect him using Jurassic Park-style cloning technology, and chaos ensues. It's, as I say, my favourite comic I've written. It's very contained. It's one and done, like all of the first three issues of Knight and Squire. And I'm so pleased with Knight and Squire. The support I've got from editor Janelle Siegel and, you know, the wonderful artwork. He adds a million jokes, does Jimmy Broxton. We've just made our master list of all the characters we've created during the entire series, which is going to go in the back of 5 and 6. And we've created over 120 new British heroes and villains, all of which have names and costumes. And but my aim here is to harm, physically and perhaps mentally, the makers of the DC Encyclopedia. They'll need a little extra book, a little British edition.
Well, that's excellent. No, and you've answered my next question, which was how much editorial is allowing you to do, or are there parameters? And it sounds like there are none, and that's fantastic.
I'm sure there are parameters. In fact, we've discovered some parameters in terms of what we're allowed to get away with in terms of innuendo.
Okay.
But those parameters were quite a way beyond what we thought they'd be. Being rude is all right if you're British, I've discovered. And some of the emails I have to send Janelle make me blush. She always asks what these things mean, so I have to, you know, give it in clinical terms. She asked the other day what a BAP was, and I sent an email saying, well, it's a small loaf. Sold in British bakeries, of course, it's also a euphemism for breasts.
Well, and you've done a good job at educating us all with the notes in the back as well. So
I don't know, I sometimes feel like the notes in the back are wimping out on my part. You know, I think maybe I should have just let people go for total immersion, but maybe it's less alienating this way. I have never experience such an extreme critical reaction on Knight and Squire. There is nobody out there who's going, oh, it's okay. you know, people either are really loving it or full of a absolutely raving fury at it. It's really created a divide. I'm quite proud of it on that basis alone.
Well, and I can see that, and I've actually seen both the positive and negative reviews for it, and I'm on the positive side because I'm a big Anglophile. I've, you know, loved things like The Goonies and Python and straight British drama as well. So you know, I've always been interested, and I even remember reading reprints of the first couple times that we saw The Knight and Squire from the 50s. So you know, it was really great to see Grant bring the Club of Heroes back as he did. And then, you know, for you to be able to take it that one step further and really flesh these characters out. And also, interesting currently, that you're writing Cyril's stories and Dick Grayson's stories, because here are the two sidekicks that now, you know, have the mantle of the hero they served. And it seems like, you know, Cyril's having a little bit more fun than Dick initially had.
Well, yeah, Cyril's quite burdened in a way. You know, he's a little socially awkward. He can march straight through to the problem when he sees it, but he needs Burl around to sort of do the subtle stuff, to sort out the you know, the complexities of the situation. They make a really good pair that way. I'm trying to move Dick back towards being a little bit more fun-loving in Batman and Robin. Because, you know, that's one of the things I've always liked about him, that he's got the capacity for that. And it struck me that with being the only Batman as he was there for a while, he might have felt a need to damp that down, a responsibility. And now there are lots of Batman. Well, maybe he can be his own sort of Batman again. But I tell you what, it's funny you mentioned The Goodies. Issue 3 of Knight and Squire consciously is formed like a Goodies episode, and it mentions it in the back. So this is one specifically for you, and perhaps nobody else on the planet. if DC are listening to this, of course it'll be entertaining for everyone.
Absolutely. How's it going so far? I mean, is it selling well enough that you think, you know, beyond the six, you might be able to revisit these characters down the line?
Well, I don't actually know yet. We haven't, well, at least I haven't seen any sales data. We're not quite, it wouldn't be out yet, would it? I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, maybe. I thought the first issue might be. I wasn't sure, though, at the least.
Maybe they're hiding it from me.
Well, I hope it's working out, and I know I'm looking forward to reading the previews to see more of Jarvis Poker, which I think everyone's got to be a fan of Jarvis Poker, the British Joker.
He features heavily at the end of the mini, actually. He's very much back. We kind of bring it full circle. There's a lot of stuff at the end that wraps it up and makes it one whole coherent story. I've finished writing it now. Jimmy is diving in and doing the last few issues. We're on target. We're talking about some lovely extras, actually. Jimmy's provided some nice adverts and little thingamajigs in every issue, and you know, there may even be more thingamajigs in a collected edition. So it's going to be a nice package, I think.
That's great. And as you say, yeah, all of these Easter eggs all over the place. In a lot of ways, it reminds me of Top 10 10 years ago.
Oh, and, yeah.
There's a lot of business happening on the page.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I love that. It's just such a different style. I think Jimmy said that this is his first pencils for something like 25 years. He's been inking all this time.
Wow.
You know, I think somebody should grab him. I think he'd be a great Vertigo artist, you know, or, you know, he's got ideas enough to write himself. I think he's a natural to write and draw though.
And has he been working for 2000 AD or, you know, some of the other British publishers?
No, he's been working mainly for DC and some Marvel, I think, but only as an inker. And
I see.
Perhaps under one of his many assumed identities. No, he has a bunch of different names.
Does he truly?
Yes, he truly does.
because I had never heard of him before this series. And yeah, I love his pencils. They're great.
I am not lying to you. I was shocked to find, having seen his pencils and been offered him as an artist and been glad to, take on board as an artist this new guy, Jimmy Broxton, to discover he was already a friend of mine. He keeps his identities that separate.
Wow.
It's quite a shock, really.
Absolutely. Let's transition, if we may, to Batman and Robin, because I thought, you know, I was pleased to hear that you were coming in with this quick little three-issue story arc before Pete Tomasi is ready to take over. And
yeah, I thought it was a nice challenge, actually. You know, it's a shame everybody knows it was done quickly, because, you know, that's what everybody's looking for, you know. But, I didn't write it any faster than I'd write most comics. it's not like they cut off in the middle of sentences. But, it was a nice little challenge.
Well, and it's fast little story, and you've introduced yet another villain, and great final page of the first issue of your story, Una Nemo,
yeah.
And I'm assuming the first thing that came to you was the image we see at the end of the story.
Yeah, I've had her in my head, as it were, for many years, actually. I pitched her as a Batman idea to Bob Schreck back in the day, and he was kind enough to turn me down because it was a terrible script, and it's not the same story at all.
Okay.
Give me lots of notes and lots of guidance, which I had the opportunity to thank him for just recently, actually. I was lucky enough to have a Batman villain handy when they asked me if I had a story. But her identity as Una Nemo is entirely new, and the second issue is full of backstory and, about who she is and how she came to be. And I'm very proud of her. I think she's just messed up.
And is, as you said, this is obviously after, you know, Bruce is back, and now Dick is able to be a little more happy in his role, and certainly everyone is official now with Batman Incorporated. So this is the, you know, first opportunity for Dick to really operate as Batman without the burden of carrying on, you know, with his friend's death, his father's death in a lot of ways.
Which Damien finds, as he says, worryingly jolly. it's exactly, you know, Damien treats everything terribly seriously. And it makes him think that Dick is going to lead them into dangerous situations. And actually, Dick does. Dick's confident in his own abilities. He sometimes likes to see how a thing plays out before he does anything about it. And he also has the thought in his head, in the back of his head somewhere, that there's now a whole organization that might be able to help them, to rescue them. So he's going to take a lot more risks, at least in my three issues. I'm speaking as if I owned the book. But, you know, that's kind of the mental trick you've got to do to write a fill-in that doesn't feel like a fill-in.
Certainly.
You've got to own the book for those three issues. You know, otherwise it'll seem like you're kind of shying away from it and just, you know, we've all seen those fill-ins back in the day. Generic things happen to our generic heroes for a while.
Well, and I think that's what's interesting about the assignments you currently have, and I think it makes for more interesting stories, because in the case of Batman and Superman in particular, we've seen the movie over and over again. We kind of, I think readers also adopt this level of ownership to the characters, where when we see the Joker show up, we've almost already formulated how Bruce Wayne is going to handle the situation. And yes, we've got this history of Dick Grayson as Nightwing and the way he handled things, but I think in all these cases of Cyril as the Knight, Dick as Batman, certainly Damian as the new character, and Lex contending with the Superman villains, we really are left with how do these people handle the crisis that the normal Batman and Superman would. And I think that obviously makes for a much more open story that we're not sure where it's going to go, and that's got to be a good challenge both for you as a writer and excitement for a reader that really doesn't know where the unpredictability will go.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things I most enjoy, actually. How do these guys handle it?
Yep.
I've had a fabulous time on the Lex Luthor run. This has been one of the most challenging and rewarding times in my creative life. Being DC exclusive, having to write basically two comics a month, I've got a pocket diary and I just write down when the deadlines are and how many pages a day I'll have to write to get to them.
Okay.
And it makes me feel part of serial fiction for the first time. Like, you know, to be highfalutin about it, Charles Dickens was back in the day, Conan Doyle was, all the pulp writers were. You know, we just have to get to that deadline and have to make it work by then, no matter what. That feels great to me. It's been tremendously satisfying. My work in television largely was about sitting around waiting and then panicking. The deadlines are much longer. there's time for a lot of stuff. And in comics, there's not time for a lot of stuff. Or if there is, then the stuff will be over soon.
Certainly, as you say, the Knight and Squire really is this blank slate. In the case of Batman and Robin, it's a three-issue, you know, story. So you come in, you tell your story, and that'll be it for now, at least. I hope you do get a chance to come back, at least based on that first issue, because the ability to come up with these villains, I think, is a real strong suit for you, that you are adding to the DC universe. And I was wondering, yeah, as far as editorially for Luthor in action and everything, you know, is a little bit more of a tightrope in terms of what you can and can't do?
Not really. The lovely thing is these are all tabula rasa. You know, there's certainly, we have to take care with the villains. We have to satisfy their own editorial that we're using them wisely, and that's as it should be. One of the things I love about DC is that their continuity is such that I wasn't allowed certain villains until certain times. You know, that he or she won't have escaped from prison at that time, things like that. I love the fact that there's a setup as solid as that. It's the freedom that you get to, when you're using these characters, the freedom you get to tell your own stories is great. I think that's what attracts an audience. Well, I have seen sales figures on the Lex run, and what's lovely is I think we've built them 3 months in a row now, and that's before the death issue. So, I think we've attracted people in the old-fashioned way by telling a good story.
Absolutely. And also, again, going back to that idea of, wow, I can't remember the last time we've truly seen Lex, in a modern sense, take on another villain. You know, again, I'm a big reprint fan, so I've certainly read those World's Finest where Lex and the Joker will team up and then end up fighting each other and things like that. But it's nice to see a more adult story and really a more of a puzzle in terms of how does the smartest man contend with these super villains as opposed to the strongest man.
Well, that's the lovely thing about Lex, is just his intelligence. I shouldn't have said a moment ago telling a good story. That's up for the audience to decide. You know, I'm not blowing my own trumpet. The thing about comics is that, you know, you end up being so in awe of the art and what the team do that you boast about it and forget it's yours. You know, Lex is fascinating because it's only his intelligence. You know, that's all he's got against the world. And, the issue with him and the Joker that's coming up, I'm really pleased with that. Pete's drawing this really realistic Joker. You know, you can see what's happened to his face and the musculature. You know, it's exactly in the opposite direction to the wonderful, surreal, extreme Jokers. You know, this is a real guy. And, you know, we do some good things, I think, in that issue. I've done it again there. But it's all down to Pete. He makes me look good.
You're doing something right, Paul. I'll tell you that. The story you're in the middle of right now with Vandal Savage is great. He's really, I think, when in the right hands, one of the great DC villains that is easy to ignore or forget about.
Gail's ending to that story is fabulous. I've just read her secret. It's two issues of Action followed by one issue of Secret Six, and her Secret Six ending to it is awesome. I chose those characters basically so I could work in a crossover with Gail, who is my hero. You know, it's been everything I thought. Writing dialogue for Ragdoll is everything I thought it would be.
Well, that's great, and I can understand the appeal of working with Gail, and those characters in particular, and that is really her book to cut loose. And as you say, Pete is such a wonderful partner for you in the regular run. I've loved what you did too with the annual. I thought again, interesting ideas. I don't remember ever reading a Luther or Ra's al Ghul story.
No, well, that was the spur that we asked everybody, and we said, have they met? And we didn't think they had. There is a time when Talia said to it becomes clear by an interaction between Lex and Talia that Talia thinks that Lex and her father have never met and that Lex knows almost nothing about Ra'sh. But actually, as our strip makes clear, there are good reasons why Lex would not tell her about that encounter. And she's not there for that encounter. So, you know, we thought we had a nice little hole in continuity there to play with. And the Dark Seed Bruno Mannheim Paris stuff all made such sense chronologically that, you know, there is actually no retconning involved in that annual. I'm quite pleased about that. I've just followed what was sitting there. So, it was kind of just a story that wrote itself since it was all sitting there. And I wanted to write for Darkseid since I first read about him in the Great Darkness saga for the Legion of Superheroes and then went and read all the New Gods stuff. And, you know, his speech patterns. Kirby writes the New Gods in such a way. His dialogue doesn't often work very well elsewhere, but with the New Gods, there's something about that kind of funky grandeur, the offbeatness of their dialogue that really works. And it makes them alien and it makes them scary. You know, you can't really even quite understand what Darkseid is trying to tell you. You know, he's that scary. And my wife said that after writing that issue for a while, I started to talk like that. You know, the wind changed and my voice fixed like that. And,
well,
I spoke Darkseid for a couple of days.
That's awesome. And you,
I'm sorry, I'm pronouncing him Darkseid. Sorry, Darkseid, of course.
No,
when I was growing up, I didn't know how he was pronounced, and that's always how I used to pronounce it as a kid.
I got no problem with that, Paul, and believe me, you're not the first fan that I think has a disagreement with another fan in terms of how to pronounce one of the villains' names. And the same goes for Ra's al Ghul, which I've always heard as Ra's al Ghul until the films, frankly.
Right. Because, you know, how can you tell? This is a medium where, nobody's ever going to pronounce it unless you go to a comic convention.
Absolutely. Or they wind up on a Saturday morning cartoon or something like that.
So,
actually, that is one of the things I love about Darkseid or Darkseid. I think both fit. You know, I mean, he is this devil spawn kind of character, and yet also, you know, is the representation of the dark side of emotion and humanity. So I think that, you know, both do fit.
Well, I believe the accurate one is dark side. So it's hard to get over the habits of your 9-year-old self.
No worries. And again, the annual makes sense. Again, it plays to the broader strokes of both villains, all three villains, really. You know, there's that Sorcerer's Apprentice kind of side of Lex in both stories. And also, you know, this god that's kind of screwing with this human, and also Ra's al Ghul looking for a successor. And, of course, Batman's not the first one that he would have probably considered. And, I think it's they're good ways of telling these untold stories.
Well, yeah, and, you know, the similarities between Lex and Bruce. You know, that's why I had Lex reacting. Ooh, that's... yes. That's why I wrote that scene that you haven't seen yet.
I see. Well, and that was going to lead to another question, because in Brian Azzarello's Lex Luthor, Man of Steel, I always tell him that the one issue in particular that I think is the center of that story is that lunch that Lex and Bruce Wayne have. And I am glad to hear. I really think whenever that decision was made to really pull Luthor more into the Batman world, it was really a correct move, because they are two sides of the same coin, and it is fun to see the intellectual battle that is going on between those two.
And the only thing that stops them meeting is a genre line. You know, they obviously would know each other.
Yeah, that's true. Of course, yeah, men of privilege, men of industry, absolutely. So, no, that's great. If you want, I could edit that, Paul. It's up to you.
No, let's leave that in there as a tease. No harm will come of that.
All right, fair enough. Because, yeah, I know a lot of people will be excited to know that that an encounter with Bruce is coming. So,
it's not an encounter with.
Ah. All right, well, then we'll leave it blank and then see what you have planned. It should be interesting. You're obviously taking to these roles of writing these stories, because in some ways I can appreciate, from a reader's standpoint, it's almost like a big tease of, hey, guess what? You're writing Action Comics. Bad news, Superman's not in it. And the same goes for Batman in the circumstances. Obviously you're playing well to not having these main characters, on the front stage, but if anything, you're elevating the supporting characters to front stage status. But I also wonder I hope that at some point you do get a chance to write some Superman proper and some Bruce Wayne Batman proper.
Well, I don't so much see the difference with Bruce in that that is the Batman. And that is a Batman, at least. But with Superman, yes, it will be satisfying to get to him. And I really love Bruce, but, you know, I don't have a problem with writing for Dick in that circumstance. But it would be nice to get hold of some heavy hitters. Let's see what the future brings.
Okay, consider this like the seventh inning stretch. And this will be an actual story about Bruce Wayne and Batman and the Joker. It comes from the great Walt Simonson, who, as always, I'm always thrilled when he comes on. It really is exciting for me because, as you guys can appreciate, Walt is part of that group of creators that really blew my mind at a very young age. And so it is, I mean, it's great meeting everybody, but really the guys like Walt Simonson and the Neil Adams and the Denny O'Neills and the Marty Pascos, and there's a big age group in there, but those guys really, it's really a pleasure, and it's very sweet that they are so kind to me and giving of their time and, sharing their memories with us. So let's hear about this very interesting sketch that Walt did that turned into a classic Batman story right in the heart of the Bronze Age, now on Word Balloon.
What was that one cover or painting that you did that became either a cover or the inspiration for a text piece of Batman's? I remember.
Probably it was a Joker cover.
That's the one, yes.
There was a gentleman named Todd Reese. Might be Rice, I'm not sure. It's R-E-I-S. Todd created 3D boxes, like shadow boxes, of comic book covers. And he would get a series of, he'd get a whole bunch of the same cover, and he would cut out all the figures and cut out the backgrounds, and he would build out, using little dark pieces of wood, he would build out layers from the cover and kind of create a 3D image based on the 2D image that's in the cover by using multiple cutouts of various characters and building almost like a strobe effect in 3D. It was very cool. Did a bunch of these, and he did some of them. Some were sold as art objects, and other ones, there are guys like me, there were a lot of professionals who really liked them, and what would happen is he would offer a trade one of these boxes in trade for a drawing.
Okay.
And in my case, he got a hold of me, wanted to see if I'd be interested in doing a trade for a shadow box. I was delighted. I said, sure, I'd love to. And I got a shadow box, actually, of the wraparound cover of the X-Men Teen Titans team-up from back in the early 80s.
The big dollar comic book, or $2
yeah,
maybe by then.
Had a lot of figures on it. Had a lot of figures.
Absolutely.
Had a dark side in the back. And Todd just did a stellar job. I'm looking at it right now.
Awesome.
But I knew it was going to be a lot of work. And I wanted to do a drawing that was worth the work I thought he'd be putting into it. So I did an oversized drawing of Batman and the Joker in a drawing. They're kind of, it wasn't drawn for commercial purpose, for a cover, for commercial stuff. I just really done as a trade piece for Todd. And the Joker has got a couple of 45s. He's kind of like a Berserko shadow almost. He's a couple of big 45s, and he and Batman are up on the top of a skyscraper, and there's, you know, the usual gargoyles down below, weird faces on the buildings, and all that kind of stuff. And it was an oversized drawing, and honestly, probably one of my best drawings.
Absolutely, man.
So I thought the trade came out even, because as I remember it, Todd was reluctant to give up the shadow box, and I was reluctant to give up the drawing. So I thought that meant that we came out about right.
Very cool.
So somewhere along the way, I kept a stat of the drawing, had a photostat made. And somewhere along the way, I think what happened, you'd probably check with Len and make sure I'm remembering this right. It's been a long time. But I think I showed it to Len Wein, who was editing at DC at that time. And Len loved it. One of the things that DC used to do, I don't know if they still do it, but they did do it back in the Julie Schwartz day, into the time of my career. They would occasionally, Julie would have covers commissioned. He'd say, oh, I have an idea for, you know, have Hawkman fighting a giant ape or whatever it would be, and an artist would draw that. And they would have a writer write a story to that cover.
Gotcha.
So the cover would come first as the idea, and then a story would be built around it. And Len said, oh, can we use this as a cover? And we'd love to have a story with this cover. And I said, sure. Nope. You know, I mean, it was fine with me. I checked with Todd, obviously, since he owned the drawing. I felt I couldn't really give it away without his knowing about it or his permission. And he was happy to do it. So because it was not designed as a cover, all the stuff that was of interest, really, the fighting and the Joker and Batman, were right up at the top of the cover where the logo would normally be. So I did a special logo that ran down along one of the buildings, kind of like almost like a spotlight around the corners of the buildings.
Yep.
That said Batman or whatever it said, so that they could actually run the cover, have the characters at the top of the panel, and still have the logo and the other stuff they needed inside in the art. That all worked out very nice. It was a good piece. They did a nice job coloring it. And I don't remember who did the inside story now. It wasn't me. But it did come in. It did end up being an actual cover for a comic. But it was done originally as a kind of a trade piece for a friend of mine.
Very cool, man. Yeah, and I remember you telling me that story. And I remember seeing that cover as well, because it was either part of one of the anniversary issues or, you know, I'm sure that it, or collected maybe in, you know, a bunch of great Batman covers and art and stuff.
I think it's turned up in a couple places as, you know, just by itself as an image. But it worked out really well. I'm pretty happy with that drawing.
Outstanding.
It took about 3 or 4 days to do.
Another talk about a character that was a Batman but not Bruce Wayne. Of course, Thomas Wayne in the Flashpoint event, which was the last event before the New 52. And, man, it's been a couple years since Flashpoint. But Flashpoint gave Brian Azzarello, Eduardo Risso, and Dave Johnson the chance to do Batman Night of Justice, which was such a great three-issue miniseries for the Flashpoint event. I'm really glad that DC turned it into a trade, because it is, as Azzarello usually does, turn out to be such a great Batman story in its own way. And you get a very different perspective, because Thomas Wayne is not his son. And the way events happened hit him very differently than it happened to Bruce. And it's fun to compare this catalyst of Crime Alley to what's going on in Gotham right now, the television series. And it's interesting to contrast and remember. If you haven't picked up Batman Flashpoint Night of Justice, I recommend that you do and go to InStockTrades.com or one of your other stores or whatever. But get that book and check it out. It's an amazing Batman story. And when we pick up our conversation with Azzarello, only issue one had come out, so there were still a lot of questions. And that's good, because that way it doesn't spoil the story. Because as Brian says, you know, it was only three issues. He had 60 pages to tell this story. But it's great. And I think you'll enjoy this conversation with Brian Azzarello, now on Word Balloon.
First of all, Flashpoint Batman is fantastic. Great first issue. Nice to see the entire 100 Bullets team back together.
Yeah.
Is Dave doing all three covers?
Yes, he is.
Man, we think Bruce Wayne is a clenched fist. The way Eduardo is drawing him, and I'm assuming this was part of your direction to him, Thomas Wayne has just got this permanent scowl.
Yeah, he's not a very happy man.
And we thought, yeah, and I mean, we certainly thought Batman, Bruce was a driven man.
Well, Bruce is a brooding man, you know.
And what is Thomas?
I don't think Thomas broods at all.
No, he acts.
Yes.
And doesn't suffer fools and really just cuts to the chase of, you're a problem, let's fix it. We see that really from the start in that first scene, even with the psychiatrist.
Right.
Very interesting. I love the relationships with recognizable characters from Commissioner Gordon, now Security Gordon, I guess Security Chief Gordon. And and also, it looks like Harvey Dent is kind of, has got, at least for now, the heart in the story. Or it seems to be the, you know, the human being in the story.
Well, they're all human beings.
Well, you know what I mean.
I think you're going to see Gordon at the heart of the story. You've only got one issue so far.
Very interesting, man. A really interesting world, and why his Thomas's choices from a business front to why does he, you know, the need to put the costume on. I mean, there's a guy that really, even more so, you know, doesn't really, there's not much of a line between Batman and Thomas Wayne. Or
right.
Division.
Right. Yeah, he's not a millionaire playboy.
Yeah, and doesn't need to put on any type of public front.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, is Donald Trump, is he kind of was he kind of an inspiration in terms of what kind of guy Thomas Wayne is?
Donald Trump's not an inspiration for me in the least.
Well, I don't even mean from any type of, you know, humanitarian of the year sort of thing, but just in terms of, yeah, like, all right, this is what I want, get it done.
No. No.
Okay. It's been, you know, honestly, every time you come back to Batman, it is always a little different. The Wednesday Comics was very different from Broken City. Joker is certainly a different, I mean, Batman's not in it, but you, I guess we kind of consider it a Batman-esque sort of story.
Well, every time I do Batman, I want to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
You know? There's, you know, that character, he works so well, I think, because you can pull out little different aspects of him and really make him the focus of the story, you know?
But
he's really just treating these things like myths.
But like this, as opposed to Bruce and everything, you know, I don't think Thomas is really looking for any sort of truth other than, you know, this is in my way. I will do what I need to do to get whatever obstacle it is out of my way.
Yes, but that's not always the best way, and if you know what I mean.
Sure, sure. Yeah. Well, and also I loved in the fight with Croc, what's going through his mind, and it's interesting to see the crime alley scene. And am I right? It's almost as if he is, it's like, what, you know, it's that cathartic, what I would have liked to have done if I had the chance. And maybe that's the thing. Maybe crime alley was his missed opportunity. Is that a fair way to see it? And that being Batman is, I'm never going to let that happen again.
Well, yeah, he holds a grudge.
Right.
Maybe even more so than Bruce, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, and of course, I mean, that is the thing that I think as people become adults, they hear about and see, unfortunately, that when a parent survives the death of a child, it's really, in a lot of ways, more traumatic than the child suffering a parent's death.
Right. Yeah, I mean, let's see. Well, I think Bruce fights crime to avenge his parents' death, and Thomas fights crime because it killed his family. He's a lot angrier, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think I don't know. Joe says he's a lot like me.
Well, I think you're friendlier than that, but that's all right.
Well, you know, I like to get things done, too.
I don't know if this is subconscious or not. The colors remind me of Dark Knight in a lot of ways. And I don't know why, but a lot of the, just, you know, certainly the, you know, you've got the conversations of Thomas and Gordon on the rooftop. And for whatever reason, it occurred to me that it felt very Dark Knight Returns to me.
Uh-huh. Well, that's Trish. You know.
Okay.
She's brilliant.
Yes, she is.
Yeah.
Is it its own story? I mean, that, you know, how much does it dovetail into Flashpoint beyond being this is the universe? Or is this just one story in the Flashpoint universe?
It'll dovetail a little.
Okay.
Some of his motivations in Flashpoint you'll understand them better because of this series.
Okay.
You know, it's but it works. You know, like Flash isn't in it.
All right. Yeah. Will we see other heroes in it?
There are no heroes in this book.
Will we see other people fighting crime that are costumed in this book?
No, we won't.
Okay. will we go back in his past anymore? I mean, like I said, we've replayed the Crime Alley scene a bit. And
yes, we're going to go back into his past.
Okay. That's, you know, I just finished talking to Jeff Lemire about his books, and he's doing the Frankenstein Creature Commandos Flashpoint thing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's so interesting, and that's why I like this event, is because I really think a lot of people initially thought, you know something, with all the changes coming in the new version of the DC Universe, I can blow this stuff off. But there's really interesting stories happening here, and also in such a concentrated form. You've only got 3 issues to really tell this story.
Right. So, yeah, and nobody should blow this off. You know? Especially now that what's going to happen in September.
Is anything that we see in this miniseries, will there be reverberations post-Flashpoint?
In the Batman series?
Yes.
God, I hope not.
Okay.
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, regardless, man, I mean, that's the thing. I think your self-contained stories are you know, A Broken City pretty much was a self-contained story. Certainly the Wednesday's Comics Batman story was. Joker has been, or was.
Yeah.
No, this is great. Honestly, as soon as I heard, you know, that you were doing the Batman one, I know a lot of people, they're like, okay, this will be a fun ride, so this is going to be cool. And
it gets a lot bumpier.
Good. No, that's great, man. Terrific.
I think next month people are going to wet themselves.
Well, yeah, I'm assuming we'll see more of the Joker. I mean, we got a little tease at the end of issue 1.
Yeah.
So, and Croc, and more bat.
Well, really no more Croc.
Right. Yes, exactly. And that was the thing. Yeah, I was going to say. Now you've taken, you know, Croc is eliminated from the Flashpoint universe. Will we see more other Batman villains before the 3 issues are up?
You'll see some more Gotham characters for sure.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure. No, that's excellent, man. And like I said, I don't want you to spoil. So
no, it's only 3 issues. So if I talk about it, you know?
No, I understand.
I only have 60 pages here. I'm putting it all in that.
A couple of weeks ago, I had Scott Snyder on, and we talked about Batman and the Black Mirror, and I can't help it. And I know Scott's sick of me saying it, although I know he's pleased that I like it as much as I do. But he and Jock and Francesco Francavilla, those 11 issues of Detective Comics, it really is one of the greatest Batman stories in which Bruce Wayne has no part in it. It really is my favorite Dick Grayson as Batman story, just in terms of it being Dick solving a crime on his own terms. And, I mean, you know, there's a lot of character moments in this story, not only from Dick, but also Commissioner Gordon. And we learn more about Commissioner Gordon's son, who we see in Batman Year One, the little kid that Bruce saves. What did he save? And what kind of man has James Gordon Jr. become? We've seen it played out a lot in the New 52. It started in the Black Mirror, and a guy that handled the art chores on that was Francesco Francavilla. And again, we get this very interesting international perspective on Batman from Francesco. And he really carried a lot of the emotion of the story in his art, as we discussed. So let's pick up our conversation with Francesco Francavilla, talking about his great run with Scott Snyder on The Black Mirror in Detective Comics with Jock, now on Word Balloon.
First, I want to talk about Detective, and again, congratulate you and Scott for such an incredible story. I'm almost glad that they moved it to the main feature, because taking nothing away from the story that Scott was telling with Jock, I just think there was a lot of interest in Jim Gordon and his son going back to Batman Year One and everyone wondering what happened to this child.
Yes, thank you for enjoying the read. Definitely, that's, I would call one of my favorite books that I've drawn in my career. And definitely the book that, you know, if I had to pick one book to put in my luggage on the desert island, you know, that would be it. So the thing is that that specific issue, 875, was all along planned to be as a standard, as a full issue. It wasn't part of the backup original part.
It's an incredible book, and, you know, as we were setting up to record, I told you earlier, I feel there's a lot of subtext in Scott's story, and that you have to carry a lot of the emotion in the art, both from a color standpoint and just the drawing, because there's a lot of emotions that aren't being expressed, both the fear of Jim Gordon's part and whatever psychotic thoughts his son is having during these same conversations.
Right. That's our, like I was mentioning earlier, it's a labor of love. Me and Scott have been talking a lot on the phone back and forward about the story, and, you know, we just want to make the best story that we can. So there was a lot of this creepy feeling going on about if James is really this psychopath killer, or it's just, you know, a victim of a series of circumstances. And I think we kind of nailed that ambiguity, because I'm reading from several reviews that people think that the Peter Pan killer may actually kill, you know, Barbara's friend. So I'm not going to say yes, it did, or it is not, but just that... the fact that people is taking these two different positions is what we wanted. So,
did you color the story as well?
Yes, I did. Man. I've been coloring all my work in the last 2 years, I believe. So.
I thought so, given what I've seen both at your blog and all the other places that you worked. I mean, the coloring does seem consistent. And that's the thing. I think that as much as you're, you know, drawing, I think the color is really... you know, carrying a lot of the emotional pull in this story.
Yeah, I started coloring probably with the Third Dark of Zorro that I did with Matt Wagner.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, you know, I always say that if I'm going to color my work, I'm going to use the color as a storytelling element, because it's not... I'm not much for literally coloring, you know. So I use the color just to create the feeling of or some tension or the fear, the danger. You know, try to express those moments also through colors as well as, you know, the visuals of the line work.
Wonderful. Well, it shows, and I think to great effect. You know, you can tell that James Gordon looks like his father, but it's, you know, did you have any models in mind for what his son would look like?
No, I didn't. I mean, once again, there was a lot of talking us on the phone with Scott about, you know, what kind of look we were supposed to give to him. And Scott was insisting in having him to be, I mean, as... normal looking, or you know, almost like someone that you see in the street, you wouldn't even notice. So a very average, maybe a slightly even boring guy. And I think the idea of the glasses was mine, because I said, you know, I can get some the glasses, make almost like. It was a bit recalling his dad's glasses, and also to make life more like, again, more a normal guy, you know, someone that you wouldn't think to be a killer or,
sure,
or something. And, or something that, someone dangerous. And I played a bit the Black Mirror theme that Scott was bringing in his first art. in the diner scene, where you pretty much look like Gordon is looking at the mirror image of himself, but, you know, a younger himself. But not quite with the same goodness that Gordon has, you know, so he's a black mirror, so maybe that's everything that Gordon is not, you know, it's on the other side of the mirror.
No, I understand you. I'm looking at the magazine now. There's that great scene right at the beginning where Gordon is standing on the bridge, and you can't help but think. And I want to ask about your process with Scott, because it's pretty obvious, I think, to longtime Batman fans. That's that same bridge where Batman saved Jim, the child, back in that first Batman Year One story.
Right. Yeah, it was. We've been trying to give a little hint to what is, you know, the origin story that we are in a certain way tributing here. So the bridge was important. It's also in later on in the double spread with Gordon driving, and, you know, remembering some of the moments of James Jr. And his caption, they say, I don't know if it was the fall, you know. Here, so there is another connection to Batman Year One, when the baby fell from the bridge.
Yeah.
Another Easter egg that kind of I threw in, and Scott didn't even know about it. It was a little surprise to him as well. He's having Junior dressed as a Joker. That was in the script. But I kind of went with the colors of The Killing Joke.
Oh, great.
Yeah, you know,
I'm looking at it now. Absolutely. That's awesome.
So that was a bit of the costume that the Joker is in, will dress later in The Killing Joke.
That's terrific.
Make a little more, yeah.
No, that's terrific. Well, and, you know, it's... I also, and you know, this might be a question too for Scott, but I'm going to ask you, Gordon standing on that bridge, it almost seems like that's the last time that he really felt he connected with his son, because I really think there's a great psychology going on in Commissioner Gordon where he regrets that his first marriage ended. And I think in those scenes with even, you know, when James Jr. is visiting, you can kind of tell that, if anything, he represents that failed marriage, and it probably pushes his ability to connect with his son even further away. And it's almost that he, you know, maybe his job took him away from his son in the beginning, and it's reinforced now that he's divorced that his son is even further away from him, and he still doesn't understand this kid. And that must be, you just kind of feel that frustration, I think, throughout the story with Commissioner Gordon, with his son.
Yeah, I mean, again, if eventually you get a chance to set up an interview with Scott, he will go in more detail about all the background of this story. But we were trying to give that the feeling of, I mean, he failed, you know.
Yes.
With his son.
Yeah.
He did turn out what he wanted to be, and we were trying to get this kind of feeling also through the book, and I think he kind of showed. So I guess he worked it.
Well, it's terrific, man. Now, when do you get back to Detective? When is your next issue?
I will be back again. This full issue were planned all along before even there was the 20 pages deal.
Mm-hmm.
So I was supposed to do like short backups, and then there were this full issue where Scott was planning to evolve this story side by side, because eventually the whole thing comes together. So at the end of you know, the first year of this new Detective run, everything will come together. Also, the Gordon story that is, it may seem that he's developing on its own, it still has tie-in with the Batman story in the main feature. So, So now we will have a new arc, which is Angry City. We dropped back on the book, and it will be on for 876, 877, and 878. And I'll be back on 879.
Okay.
And then Jock will do 880, and then it will be 881 will be me and Jock together. It will be an extra large issue.
Wow. Okay. That's great.
Where everything will be wrapped up.
I see. Okay. That's cool. Well, that's great. And again, taking nothing away from Jock's work, I mean, he's a beautiful artist as well.
He's talented.
Oh, yeah. And that's the thing. I think Scott's very lucky to have both of you on this book. That's pretty terrific. I mean, it's such a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. I think also sometimes, you know, I read that people say, Scott is lucky that DC gave him these two guys. Scott actually picked us up, you know, he wanted us, and I like that DC was okay in giving us, you know, assigning us to this book, because it's like now it's a big family.
That's terrific.
Me, Jock, David Baron, and Mastermind Scott, so...
That's
I have to say, it's been a real pleasure to work with all the Batman editorial, you know, from Mike Mars to Jenna Laslin and newcomer Katie Kubert. I mean, it's a real pleasure working on this book. From every point of view, you want to see it, you know, from the creative, from the administrative. I mean. Anytime you see it, it's all good.
That's terrific. Well, going to your blog and seeing the times that you've drawn Batman, both in period pieces and also modern sketches and stuff, I'm glad that the Bat Office was able to get you and that you have time in your schedule.
All right, wrapping things up, it's time to hear from filmmaker Brett Culp. Brett made a great documentary this year called Legends of the Night, real stories of real people inspired by the Batman mythos and the ways that they let it manifest in their own lives. A very inspirational story about real people and taking an ideal and you know, not being weird about it, but really finding good and finding a kind of ethic that they could apply to their lives and make their own lives better and others' lives better as well. Very inspirational story. And Brett Culp has made an interesting film. It is now on DVD, Legends of the Night. Let's hear from Brett Culp, now on Word Balloon.
Brett Culp, welcome to Word Balloon. Very excited that you decided to join me today.
Oh, well, thanks for the invitation. I'm delighted to be here.
Congratulations on reaching your Kickstarter goal and getting the movie made. It looks fantastic. And I think the great thing is, the general theme is, much like another documentary, Waiting for Superman, you've proven that Batman has transcended whatever Warner Brothers or DC Comics dictate, and the idea of Batman is universal and very powerful.
Yeah, you know, we all, I mean, there's a level at which there are certainly these official stories that are told, and they've inspired us for 75 years now. My goodness, this character's been around for so long. But there's also this character of Batman that exists in our minds, you know, that is inspiring to us. You know, people have asked me, this movie, Legends of the Night, tells the story of people from around the U.S., who were inspired by their childhood love of Batman to do great things in the world and to do amazing things in their own lives and in their communities and the lives of others. And it's really a great exploration of the power of stories and how we can be inspired by them and how heroes can really exist in the world and that we have that superhero within us. And, you know, as I've gone through this process, people have asked me, you know, what's your favorite version of Batman? Like, sure. Which actor, or, you know, which story? And to me, after working on this, my favorite Batman is the little kid who puts the cape around their neck and runs through the backyard and imagines the adventure that they could go out on. And, you know, so I think that's what this film is all about. It's about that Batman, the Batman that lives in us.
Absolutely. And I can't think of any Batman fan that as a 4-year-old kid didn't watch, or even younger, and thought, well, I could be this guy. I mean, he doesn't have superpowers. He's not an alien. He is just an example of physical perfection and a very strong moral compass to do the right thing. And, you know, my God, if that isn't attractive to a young mind, I don't know what is.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, that is the thing. I mean, you know, so many of these other superhero characters, they're given their powers because of circumstances outside of their control. And then the heart of the story for them as a hero is, what are they going to do with that? How are they going to, use that for their own selfish means, or are they going to use it to make the world a better place? That's not Batman's struggle. You know, Batman's struggle comes from that childhood incident, you know, where he witnesses possibly the worst thing that anybody could ever see in their whole life, which is the death of their parents. And he makes this choice from a very young age. I have been hurt, I am in pain, but I will use that to bless the world, make a positive difference, and not let this kind of thing happen to somebody else. And I think, you know, all the young people in our society, even though they may not go through anything that traumatic in their life, they have that choice from a very early age. Am I going to choose to be a hero, or am I going to choose to be selfish? Am I going to choose to do what's great for the world and make a positive difference, or am I just going to pursue my own interests? And I think a character like Batman can inspire young people from the very beginning of those choices to make the bigger choices, to make the heroic decisions. And I think that can make a positive difference in the trajectory of their lives and in the way the world goes.
You know, obviously a lot of people remember this summer the San Francisco kid, Bat Kid. And it certainly got a lot of publicity. But I remember seeing your Kickstarter trailer and that you found a very similar story as well. You know, and I'll let you tell that story. But and also I would ask as a follow up after you tell it, if, you know, I hope the Bat Kid publicity, you know, provides the movie an opportunity and gets people to kind of pick up and think, oh, you know, maybe we're going to see Bat Kid. Obviously, I think your movie was finished after that story, but you have an equally inspirational story that, you know, is part of your movie.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I felt when I watched the San Francisco Bat Kid event that went so viral and became such a huge media event, for me, it was a very validating experience.
Cool.
Because I had spent the past 2 years of my life working on a film that essentially says, you know, Batman has the power to inspire us. Batman has the power to, you know, create something positive in our life. And you know, watching this community of people coming together around this young person and his Batman story, and watching them celebrate and be excited about that, I loved that. And as you said, you know, our story, our movie includes a story of a little boy named Kai who lives in Texas. And even though the San Francisco Bat Kid was the one that went huge and viral because they invited the whole city of San Francisco to be part of it, wishes like that on a much smaller scale have been going on for a very long time. It's just that they don't invite the whole community to be there. And so, you know, they're not as well known and they don't get the same media coverage. And it's just not as big of a community event. But young people are getting those kind of wishes. Boys and girls are getting those kind of wishes all the time, and which is a beautiful thing. And our movie includes a story of a little boy named Kai who went through leukemia treatment, and that was his wish. His wish was to be Batman, and to have a Batman adventure. And so the city of Arlington, Texas, did that for him. And the story that's told in our film is of that adventure that he got to have. But it digs even a little deeper into what it was in his spirit and in his mother's spirit that caused that that they wanted that to be his wish. That there was something very symbolic and emotional for their family for him to have it affirmed for him that, yes, he is Batman. He has the spirit of Batman in him, and he used that spirit to help him get through this very difficult treatment.
That's really cool. And, yeah, I can't imagine how you find these stories. I mean, you know, I've heard similar things like that. Do you go to Make-A-Wish in some of these places? And I mean, yeah, where did you find some of these more personal achievement, you know, Batman stories?
You know, it's actually, I wish I had a more dramatic, mysterious answer, but the answer was really Google. I mean, when I first started this, I did these Google searches for inspired by Batman. And I would go through, you know, usually you just look at the first page of Google results, and I would go through pages and pages and pages. I mean, I made it like page 120 of the Google results. And, you know, people's blogs would turn up where they had written these blog posts about how Batman had inspired them, you know, their Facebook posts. Facebook comments, Twitter handles. You know, I kind of went through the process from a research perspective for about 3 months at the very beginning of this process. And then once we started telling the world what we were doing back in 2012, and, you know, our Twitter account started to build up with followers, and we started saying, hey, we're looking for these stories, they started coming from everywhere. I mean, literally, I mean, hundreds of stories have been sent to us over the past 2 years, and particularly after the trailer that we released by a Kickstarter last February went so viral. You know, we just got so much feedback, and there were so many amazing stories that were wonderful that just didn't fit in the film. And the film has a wide variety of stories in it. I think each story in this film is unique and different. Each person's story is a unique angle on how Batman and storytelling and heroic stories in general can inspire and change us. And it was difficult to have some of these amazingly moving stories come in through email to our studio and have to look at them and go, you know what, this is so beautiful, but we can't use it because it's too similar to one we've already captured, or something like that. And so, you know, I hope that each story in the movie will represent many of the other Batman fans and heroes that are doing great things in our world every day.
And it isn't just, you know, stories like Batkid or the kid in Arlington as well. I mean, you've got some sort of college course or something called Batman. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know, the film, we wanted to show how Batman is really working in our culture, and the story of a hero like Batman can work in our culture as a vehicle for helping people do things that wouldn't normally exist. So, you know, yeah, the film does include, you know, this story that's of Kai that's similar to the Batkid story. But then it also includes stories like you just mentioned of Travis Langley, whose love of Batman and as a child and his love of psychology, and he became a psychology teacher. He had this creative idea to create a college course on psychology called Batman. And what it allows is for young people who, you know, I mean, it's one thing to sit down and say, now today we're going to talk about Freud. Now today we're going to talk about Jung. And, you know, how interesting is that? But what he's doing is he's using Batman stories and characters and scenarios to explain these concepts, because when you look at all these diverse lineup of Batman villains, in many cases they fit into these, you know, many of these abnormalities.
You
and
bet.
Let's talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs from the perspective of the Batman villains and where they fit into that, and, you know, stuff like that. And so it was really awesome to do that. And there are other stories. I mean, there's a story about a guy who's using Batman with comics with young people in therapy. You know, it's hard when young people are having emotional challenges. They don't want to open up. How do you get them to open up? He's using these stories from Batman comics based on the challenges they're having to get them to talk about those characters, which they're very comfortable doing, to then get to the heart of what's going on in their life and what they're dealing with. It kind of gives them this very comfortable avenue to do that. So, I mean, there's stories like that. There's stories of other people, not just young people, but people who are, you know, adults who have struggled with physical challenges, mm-hmm. who every day are using that Batman symbol, that kind of courage that Batman has to get through their challenges, and all the way to Michael Uslan, who's in the film, who's been the executive producer of every Batman film since 1989, and it was his love of Batman as a child that inspired him to go through 10 years of no's and doors being slammed in his face during the 1980s when he was trying to sell the concept of a dark and serious Batman, and everybody thought it was a terrible idea, and everybody rejected him. And now, look what it's become. I mean, you know, and that was a very Batman spirit that he portrayed to even bring Batman to the silver screen to begin with.
Yeah, no question. And I think Mike Uslan in the films and another guy in your movie as well, Denny O'Neill, along with the artist Neil Adams. I think in the comics, obviously, Denny and Neil are responsible for the modern Batman. It started with them in 1969, but even today, really, the through line is there, and it is their Batman that is represented today. And as you say, yeah, Michael having to, you know, kind of combat that bam, wham, pow, you know, approach that the Adam West show had. And by the way, I'm sure you feel the same way. There's room for the Adam West approach, and I know you said it as well.
Oh, yeah.
You love all iterations of Batman, but it was tough getting Hollywood to kind of come over, and that might be incredible to hear from younger listeners, but it really was this major obstacle. And as you say now, my God, you know, the Dark Knight, gets nominated for Best Picture, and I mean, you know, is second only to The Avengers as far as, you know, superhero films, but is right there in the top 10 of most, you know, successful films of all time. It can't just be comic book and Batman fans. Batman truly is universal, and it took guys like Denny and Michael to kind of help make that happen.
Absolutely, absolutely, and that's one of the things that's very interesting. You know, obviously the geek culture and the Comic-Con fans, and you know, the people that read the comics every Wednesday, you know, they love this film and they're so excited about it. I didn't realize when we started how validating for many of them this documentary would be. You know, I've got people now that are taking their parents and their friends to this movie in the theater and saying, "This is why I love Batman. You've been making fun of me for years. This is the reason, because it's awesome." You know, and I didn't realize when I first started that was going to happen, that that's the way they were going to respond to it. I totally understand why now that, you know, I've kind of, you know, shown it to them and shown them pieces of it. I totally get it. But it's the power of what you're saying is that, you know, Batman is now just right at the heart of pop culture. I mean, you don't have to be, I mean, it's amazing now when I walk around, I mean, literally, every time I go out in public, I see someone wearing a Batman shirt. And they might never have read a Batman comic book, but they know who Batman is, and they love Batman enough to wear the symbol on their chest because of what it means to them. Even if they never know who Michael Uslan or Denny O'Neill or Neil Adams or Frank Miller or any of those guys are, they know that. And that's what's amazing about this character, to watch what these innovative storytellers, you know, particularly like in the 70s and 80s, created with this character that is now just permeated so deep into our consciousness. And I think what you're saying is interesting about the Adam West version. I do think that, you know, when I was at Comic-Con this year in San Diego, I was seeing how much the 1960s Batman is like becoming cool again.
Yep.
You know, I'm seeing people with the shirts and the statues and the artwork. And, you know, there was a day where the free giveaway bags at Comic-Con were 66 Batman.
Yep.
And, you know, now it's coming out to DVD in the summer. And now you've got Lego Batman, you know, that is that lighter. It's not the same as Adam West Batman, certainly, but it is that more not take itself so seriously kind of Batman. And so I think now we're coming to a time where literally, whereas all the fans were afraid of Adam West for so long because they thought it, people were making fun of their character, and they were to some extent, now there really is becoming room for us to love the Batman that's for 3-year-olds and the Batman that's for 30-year-olds, all in the same breath. Love it all. Enjoy it all. It's all Batman.
I completely agree. Well, and you know, I think it's kind of like a 12-step program or the six stages of dealing with death, because when you're a 3-year-old and you watch Adam West, it's high drama and high action. And then you hit about 10 or 12 and it's corny, and you want to stay away from it. Then you get around high school or college age and you watch it again, and then you get the joke. And then it's genius. Yeah. And you realize, like, really how great Adam West was acting on several levels, you know, delivering the action and the fun and the excitement, but also, you know, tongue firmly in cheek. And really, it is this brilliant comedy. And I agree. I'm glad that a lot of people are waking up to that, and he's getting his due in time. So that's great for that show. I also want to mention Jill Pantazzi also, because she's a comic book blogger and a podcaster as well. And you know, it's nice to see too that, you know, Batman can inspire women, and I think her story is very unique for listeners who don't know. Although I know that Word Balloon listeners are kind of hip to the, you know, comic book blog and podcast culture. But for those who don't, you can tell a little bit about Jill's story.
Absolutely. You know, Jill Pantozzi is really, I mean, I it was just my joy to get to know her. She works for the Mary Sue, and also does, as you said, all kinds of blogging, and is so fun to watch on Twitter. I mean, she's not only a sweet person, but a butt kicker when butts need to be kicked, which is awesome. I've told her several times, I want to be you when I grow up.
There you go.
And you know, she was born with muscular dystrophy, and you know, it started to show in her life when she was, you know, early childhood. And, you know, she's had a lot to overcome. It would be very easy for her to just say, you know what, I'm not going to engage, or even as a blogger just to say, I'm just going to sit at home or, you know, whatever and just be a writer. But she didn't do that. I mean, she works in New York City, drives in every day to do her job as a journalist, and parks in New York City
yep.
5 days a week and travels in there. And, you know, I mean, I got to journey with her one day as she did all that. And, I mean, it's an impressive thing. I mean, I live in Florida. I travel in New York City, and every time I have to get around, I whine the whole time about how frustrating it is and how difficult it is. And, you know, the weather comes through, and it's nightmarish, and I'm whining about it. And then I, you know, about the time I whine about it, I think about Jill, and I'm like, you know what? Jill's doing this today, too. And, you know, I don't have near the challenges she has. And so, I mean, she's absolutely an inspiration to me. I was so happy when we did the New York City premiere that she got to be there with us and be part of that. It was so much fun. And she's just an amazing person.
That's cool. And, yes, the film has been in New York. It's been in the Chicago area as well. It's on tour. Let's let people know how they can see this film.
Yeah, yeah. So if you go, there's two ways you can see this film. The way that's most fun and that we're enjoying right now is that you can see it in the theater. If you go to our website, which is wearebatman.com, there's a page for screenings at the top. You can hit showtimes. There's a little link right from the homepage there that can take you to the list. Right now, there's over 40 theatrical screenings listed there. In cities all over the U.S. And what's unique about these screenings is I just finished a theatrical tour in the month of February where I was personally in 10 cities. We went in the East Coast, and then we did 5 screenings in California, which were just wonderful, and the spirit was amazing. But what's awesome is if you go to that list, every single one of those screenings that you see there was requested by someone who wanted to bring this movie to their theater. And here's what's cool that we're doing. We're partnering with a company called Tug.com. And what happens is if you go to our website, wearebatman.com, if you don't see your city, you can request a screening of the film. And Tug, at no cost to you, will arrange a screening in your local theater for you to see it. You then have to get the word out to your friends, because what happens is there has to be a pre-sell of about usually somewhere between 55 and 75 tickets.
Sure.
As long as you get that sold within about 7 days of the event, and there's enough pre-sell tickets sold, the event happens. It's confirmed. It's a go. And the revenues that would have come to my company from that screening will instead go to the charity of your choice.
Outstanding.
So, yeah, it's a wonderful thing. It's exactly what when we made this movie, we wanted our distribution approach to be right in the spirit of Batman. Just like the movie reflects the spirit of Batman, we wanted our distribution approach to be in that vein, too. So that's what's going on right now. There are people all over the U.S. who've requested screenings, who are inviting their friends, who are working hard to get that minimum number of tickets sold, whether it's to connect with their comic shop or an organization they're part of or a group of friends they have, and get everybody to buy $10 tickets and let's go have an inspirational night and help a charity out in the process. And so we're so proud of the way that's gone and the success we've had, and we're seeing more requests pour in, so it's really fun for us.
That's terrific, and I've seen that done with cult films in Chicago. That's where I am. And I think that's a wonderful way, because certainly those kinds of art house movie theaters, because of streaming media and DVDs and stuff, have you know, fallen by the wayside. But if you can show a theater that, yes, you can get so many butts in the seats and stuff and really make it worth the while, you know, then events like this can happen. And I think that's a great way of bringing community and film back together again, and certainly for a good cause like what your movie represents. So that's wonderful. So wearebatman.com, correct?
Yep, we love it. And then additional to that, you know, you can also pre-order the film on DVD and Blu-ray. We've got some T-shirts there and cool. Stuff like that. And all of those revenues go to the not-for-profit that my wife and I are starting to support this film called the Rising Heroes Project. And that, just all those revenues, it's not about aligning our pocket. It's just about giving us the revenues we need to keep getting this film out in the world. We have dreams of getting it into schools and to educators all over the world, and also connecting it with more charity organizations so that they can use it for fundraisers. But we need resources to be able to do that. And every time you pre-order or buy a DVD or Blu-ray, you're helping us get this movie out into the world.
That's fantastic. What do you, once you, you know, the time of Legends of the Night is over and stuff, as a filmmaker, what do you want to do next?
Man, you know, my head is so spinning right now with this. You know, I have many ideas in my head for what I want to do next. I'm not sure which one of them I'm going to grab. I'm going to kind of wait and see how this project goes. But the reality for me is, you know, some filmmakers are like, look, I'm done. I want to get this film to a distributor so I can move on to the next film. For me, this entire year is going to be spent getting this movie out to the world and letting this movie be a vehicle for what we intended it for, which is inspiring people and encouraging them and helping support these not-for-profits and charities all over the world. And I'm going to spend the rest of this year doing that. And I'm excited to see what I learn along the way and who I meet and what opportunity is the right one next.
You know, if there was a Wayne Foundation, I'm sure they'd get behind your efforts because this is exactly
the... for them. Let me know if you find them.
Yeah, exactly, man. This is the kind of thing that Bruce Wayne and his civilian guys would, I think, absolutely get behind. And the good news is it is an excellent movie. It tells very inspiring stories. And it really is, as you say, I mean, there really are a wide range of stories on how Batman has inspired people. It's called Legends of the Night. Go to wearebatman.com and look up the information if there's a screening in your city or, as Brett said, follow directions on how to arrange for a screening in your town. Brett Culp, congratulations on the Kickstarter, on the film itself, and what has already been a productive 2014, and I hope the rest of the year goes equally well.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me to be here. It was a delight to chat with you.
There you go. That wraps things up for today's Word Balloon and our look at Batman through the eyes of many, both fictional and real people. And interesting to kind of take this perspective on Batman in the 75th anniversary year. I hope you enjoyed today's Word Balloon. It was brought to you by In Stock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where there are great deals happening now on books like Batman Superman Hardcover Volume 2, Game Over. Wonderful stuff from Greg Pak and Jay Lee and company. It's one of my favorite current Batman series. 42% off. It's just $14.49. You can get Mind Management from Matt Kitt, Volume 4, The Magician. 42% off, just $11.59. From Matt Fraction, Gabriel Ba, and Fabio Moon, it's Casanova, The Complete Edition Hardcover, Volume 1, Luxuria. Is 50% off. It's just $14.99. You get Lazarus Hardcover Volume 1 from Greg Rucka and Michael Lark, another great original creator-owned series that I'm really enjoying. 50% off, just $17.49. Saga Deluxe Edition Hardcover Volume 1. That's Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples. 50% off, $24.99. Where else? InStockTrades.com. Do your holiday shopping there. They will do you right. And don't forget, if your orders are $50 or more, you receive free shipping. Check it out for yourself, InStockTrades.com. John Suntra saying thanks again for listening to Word Balloon. Thank you, League of Word Balloon listeners, for your continued support. And we've got great programming still to come before November closes up and on to December with more great first-timers. And, boy, it's been a long time. I'm glad you're back, guests. And it's a whole collection of new and interesting conversations to end off 2014, usher in 2015 with great talk and interesting perspectives from the Word Balloon audience and guests. Thank you, as always, for listening. I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving. It's one of all of our favorite holidays in the United States and the other countries that observe Thanksgiving either that day or on other days, like Canada does in October. But it really is about family and your friends and the people in your lives that are important to you. I hope you all spend time with people you love and enjoy yourselves on really a great holiday that no matter what your background is, you can appreciate the sentiment behind it. Try not to think too much about the you know, other stuff. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2014.